Oh yeah, that baby, you've got what it takes. That one there from Girl Trouble and released from Gearhead Records. Before that, Cosmic Psycho's doing Some Girl, and the Greco Brothers doing Hit the Floor. That one off of the Drunkabilly Records release, Demolition of the Rehabilitation. And I'm gonna leave you with the Black Mondays today from Slit 7 Records and their tune Runaway. That's it for the Wrecking Hours today. Catch me next week, same time, same channel. We got the Monday Talk Forum up next.
That was so strong. And as I walk alone, I think of the things we've done together. What our hearts were young. I'm a walking in the rain. Tears are falling and I feel the pain. Wishing you were here by me to end this misery. And I wonder, and I've gotta wonder why she ran away. And I wonder when she would stay. My little runaway. Run, 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 run away. What went wrong with our love that was so strong? I'm a walking in the rain. Tears are falling and I feel the pain. Wishing you were here by me to end this misery. And I wonder, and I've gotta wonder why. And I wonder why she ran away. And I wonder when she would stay. My little runaway. Run, 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 run away.
After I came home from the war, I lost everything. My job, my family, but this place, this is where I started to put my life back together.
A few weeks ago, my husband of 47 years had a stroke. I'm staying here in this room while he recovers. Without this place, I don't know what I'd do.
At Volunteers of America, we envision a world where everyone has a place to call home.
12 years my family lived in that house, then it was gone, washed away in a flood. We were on the street. The day we came here, that's when I knew we could make it.
But it's not just about having a place to call home. It's about improving lives. Through our programs and support, our promise and hope, we work so that no one will be left behind. After all, who are we as a society if we don't help those who need it the most? To help strengthen your community, visit VolunteersOfAmerica.org.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
The performing arts are an important facet of life. There is no substitute for the relationship between audience and performer. Your contributions to the Henry Ford Community College Theater Program enable students and faculty to continue promoting HFCC's artistic standards. By becoming a member of the Friends of HFCC Theater, you are allowing the theater program to prosper through establishing a scholarship fund, improving costume and scene shop facilities, and enabling the continuation of musical theater productions. For more information on becoming a Friend of HFCC Theater, call 313-845-6478.
The Mix with your host, on WHFR.
My name is Bam, and I invite you to join me for my newest show called The Mix with Bam every Thursday from 9 to midnight. The three-hour mix is spun by guest DJs from around the world featuring the very best in electronic music. It's all hosted by me every single Thursday from 9 to midnight right here on the only station making waves, WHFR.
Disclaimer: this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
Hey, this is Derek. You listen to Skepticality, the official podcast of Skeptic Magazine, for Tuesday, August 28th,
2012.
Welcome back to an episode of Skepticality, the show that brings you news and interviews with skeptics and critical thinkers from all walks of life for the promotion of critical thought and science. Many of you out there might already realize it's about 2 days until DragonCon, the massive convention that myself and Swoopy are directors at. That would be the place where there's everything from pop culture to fantasy, sci-fi, and also space science and, well, skepticism. So, since the convention brings in about tens of thousands of people into downtown Atlanta, you can imagine that me and Swoopy are really busy right now. So, without any further delay, I give you Tim Farley with his skeptics past and future, along with our normal gang of friends.
Hi, I'm Tim Farley of whatstheharm.net and skeptools.com, and this is Skepticism, Past and Future. In the past, we've got the passing of Neil Armstrong and other moon-related anniversaries, and in the future, we've got kind of the dark side of crowdsourcing. Over the weekend, the news among skeptics and science fans was dominated by the death of Neil Armstrong, the first man to walk on the moon. There have been many great obituaries and memorials written online, and I'll link to a couple in the show notes. Of course, while most people enjoy the wonder and achievement of the moon landing, skeptics know of the small, misguided minority who tries to claim that we never made them. Unbelievably, they still push their nonsense even today, even in the face of plenty of evidence. This week is the fourth anniversary of one of the most visible recent debunkings of these deniers, when the TV show Mythbusters ran their NASA moon landing episode on August 27th, 2008. And September 9th is the 10th anniversary of when a denier decided to confront Neil Armstrong's Apollo 11 colleague, Buzz Aldrin, on the steps of a Hollywood hotel and got a knuckle sandwich in return. Moon landing denial is just one of the forms of misinformation that gets pushed online. Skeptics had to battle it and many forms of misinformation on the internet for years. In my recent talk at TAM 2012, I proposed that skeptics should make better use of crowdsourcing techniques to battle this misinformation. One of the reasons that I didn't have time to go into in my speech is the level to which negative use of crowdsourcing and astroturfing online is being used by our opponents. Last episode, I talked about an AstroTurf campaign being mounted by a German homeopathy manufacturer against skeptic Edzard Ernst. Recently, more examples came to light. The New York Times ran a piece last Saturday called The Best Book Reviews Money Can Buy, about how book reviews on online bookstores are often bought and sold by authors desperate to give their work more visibility or even to damage a competitor. One wonders how many authors of books about pseudoscience and the paranormal engage in this practice. Another unsavory practice that has come to light recently is the buying of fake followers on Twitter. Social media sites like Twitter are often used to promote products, both real and bogus, and appearing to have some authority on the site is viewed as key. Often, people claim authority via the number of their followers, the assumption being more followers means that person is more interesting. But it has come out that there are a number of scammy services that will sell you thousands of Twitter followers for a mere pittance. You can have tens of thousands of followers for under $100. This has led to other services being created which can detect which accounts have done this. One of these is called Fakers by a company called Status People, and I've been using it to investigate various purveyors of nonsense on Twitter. For instance, you might be impressed that Deepak Chopra has over 1 million followers on Twitter, but if you run his name through the Fakers app, you find that only 34% of those followers are actually active users of Twitter. Similarly, a California anti-GMO budget proposal account called CA Right to Know appears to have over 50,000 followers. But according to the Fakers app, as few as 10% of those, in other words 5,000, are actually active Twitter users. I encourage skeptics to do their own investigations using apps like these. Do note that the app is not perfect and uses statistical sampling techniques. And also take note that aside from real and fake, it classifies many users in a third bucket called inactive, which may include some people who simply use Twitter as a read-only service. But it does still return some interesting results. And that brings us to the end of another edition of Skepticism Past and Future. Links to additional material are in the show notes, and follow me on Twitter or Facebook under the name Krelnik, K-R-E-L-N-I-K, for a daily fact from Skepticism's past and ongoing news of Skepticism's future.
This is Bob Carroll, creator of the Skeptics Dictionary and the blog Unnatural Acts That Can Improve Your Thinking. Welcome to another episode of Unnatural Virtue. In this and future episodes, I'll be offering some brief comments on topics in critical thinking, skepticism, and science. Today's topic is the clustering illusion. In 2003, the mother of a child with leukemia in the Sacramento area thought it odd that there were several other people with cancer in her neighborhood. She did a survey and found what appeared to be an excessive number of cancers in the area. I can understand the woman's desire to find something to blame for her child's illness, and I can also understand how the average person might be led to think that there must be something in the local environment that is causing the cancers. However, several things should be considered. The woman's boundaries extended to wherever she arbitrarily decided to draw them. She included all kinds of cancers in her survey, not just leukemia. She included people who had lived in the area for various amounts of time, ranging from those who were born there to those who had moved into the area in adulthood. Epidemiologists tried to explain that when you looked at the numbers, they weren't that unusual and didn't warrant investigation into an environmental cause. The data showed no difference in the leukemia rates for her area than in the rest of the Sacramento region. The Sacramento Bee took up her cause, and eventually there was an official government analysis of the water supply that found no environmental toxins in the water. Still, the Bee persisted and identified tungsten found in tree rings as the probable culprit. Even though tungsten is not a known human carcinogen, and the connection between tungsten in trees and cancer in humans is speculative. What the Bee and their experts were calling a cancer cluster is considered an example of the clustering illusion by epidemiologists. The clustering illusion may be defined as the intuition that random events which occur in clusters are not really random events. To some, the occurrence of a number of cancers in a defined space cries out for a causal explanation in terms of some unknown environmental hazard. To others, familiar with the data and knowledgeable of proper statistical analysis, the same number of cancers occurring within the same defined space is expected by the laws of chance. The Centers for Disease Control investigated 108 cancer clusters between 1961 and 1990. None could be linked with environmental causes. It may seem improbable, but the chances are better than even that a given neighborhood in California will have a statistically significant cluster of cancer cases. The clustering illusion is due to selective thinking based on a counterintuitive but false assumption regarding statistical odds. For example, it strikes most people as unexpected if heads comes up four times in a row during a series of coin flips. However, in a series of 20 flips, there is a 50% chance of getting four heads in a row. In any short run of coin flips, a wide variety of probabilities is expected, including some runs that seem highly improbable. What would be rare, unexpected, and unlikely due to chance would be to flip a coin 20 times and have each result be the alternate of the previous flip. In any series of such random flips, it is more unlikely than likely that short runs of 2, 4, 6, 8, etc. will yield what we know logically is predicted by chance. In the long run, a coin flip will yield 50% heads and 50% tails, assuming a fair flip and a fair coin. But in any short run, a wide variety of probabilities are expected, including some runs that seem highly improbable. Finding a statistically unusual number of cancers in a given neighborhood, such as 6 or 7 times greater than the average, is not rare or unexpected. Much depends on where you draw the boundaries of the neighborhood. Clusters of cancers that are 7,000 times higher than expected, such as the incidence of mesothelioma in carrion turkey, are very rare and unexpected. The incidence of thyroid cancer in children near Chernobyl was 100 times higher after the nuclear disaster. Sometimes a subject in an ESP experiment or a dowser might be correct at a higher than chance rate over a limited period of time. However, such results do not indicate that an event is not a chance event. In fact, such results are predictable by the laws of chance. Rather than being signs of non-randomness, they're actually signs of randomness. ESP researchers are especially prone to take streaks of hits by their subjects as evidence that psychic power varies from time to time. In epidemiology, the clustering illusion is sometimes known as the Texas sharpshooter fallacy. Kahneman and Tversky called it belief in the law of small numbers because they identified the clustering illusion with the fallacy of assuming that the pattern of a large population will be replicated in all of its subsets. In logic, this fallacy is known as the fallacy of division, assuming that the parts must be exactly like the whole. Well, that's it for this week's episode of Unnatural Virtue. For more on the clustering illusion and other topics brought up in this episode, see my website, The Skeptic's Dictionary, or my blog on natural acts that can improve your thinking. In the meantime, please commit some unnatural acts in public. And don't forget, skepticism, though unnatural, is a virtue.
Hello, and welcome to The Odds Must Be Crazy on Skepticality, where that weird ex-landlord of yours inadvertently shows up in your dreams one night asking where the rent is, and the next morning you see he won the lottery on the news, and you're left confused, wondering why he cared about the rent if he's now a millionaire.
I'm Wendy Hughes.
And I'm Jarrett Kaufman.
And we're here to read you stories that make you laugh, or think, or neither.
We aim low so nobody walks away disappointed. Anyway, Wendy, it seems like we've got a special episode planned.
That's right, Jarrett. It's our... We were too busy getting ready for DragonCon that we couldn't prepare a story in time for Barbara to review it, so we picked 3 short stories with a common theme instead, and then Barbara still had time to give us notes. Episode.
Jeez, Wendy, who wrote that episode title?
You did. I wanted to call it Trio of Traveling Tales.
Oh, I remember. All right, you win. As usual, our readers can find all these stories on our site starting today under the new title, Trio of Traveling Tales, or via the link in the show notes. The first story was submitted by reader Tracy McFadden. Tracy wrote,
In 1972, I was driving along a major street in Dallas, Texas, and saw two young girls, maybe 17 or 18 years old, hitchhiking, a rather common sight in those days, and I stopped to give them a ride. They were headed to one of the girls' homes and said it wasn't too far from where we were. Having grown up in that area of Dallas myself, I said, well, where is it? Because I know this neighborhood. But the one giving me directions didn't really know the street names, so she just kept saying, turn left here, now go a block, take a right, etc., etc. Well, amazingly, where she ended up directing me to was the house that I had grown up in the first 10 years of my life. My family had moved from that house some 11 years earlier.
I love it. That must have been pretty startling for her. What did Barbara think?
I loved it too, but at least from a probability standpoint, Barbara wasn't that impressed. She pointed out that while a lot of houses fit in a reasonable radius for hitchhiking, they number in the hundreds, not hundreds of thousands, and the author did frequent this area. She agrees that to the author it must have been pretty remarkable, but less so than it seems.
Fair enough. All right, the next one comes to us courtesy of Dave.
Dave who? What's his last name?
I don't know. Ask him.
But Dave's not here, man.
I knew you were going to do that.
Of course you did. It was in the script. Anyway, Dave's story begins.
I grew up in Moses Lake, Washington, on the eastern desert side of the state. A couple blocks from us lived one of my best friends, Adam. Our families were also close, as his dad was our family doctor. When I was about 5 years old, Adam moved away out of state, and shortly after, my dad got a job in state government, and we moved to the capital, Olympia, on the other side of the state. Several years later, we moved into a new house, and I started going to a new school. When I entered my new fifth grade class, I recognized a kid, but I couldn't place him. We found out we lived a couple blocks away from each other, so we started hanging out. It wasn't until our parents met and remembered each other that we found out that Adam and his family had settled in a new house the same distance from ours as our houses were back in Moses Lake. What are the odds?
Far out. Long-lost friends who managed to find each other again through distance and lost memories. What were Barbara's notes?
Barbara's thoughts were pretty similar to my own. This one's definitely eerie, but a little less so than if they had moved much further away.
That's fair, but I still think it's groovy. What's up next?
Our last story is from R.L. Fletcher, who wrote,
I was driving my grandchildren back home to Birmingham, Alabama, after a week-long visit at our home in the suburb of Dallas, Texas. About 200 miles into the 650-mile journey, we stopped at a Starbucks in Shreveport so the grandson and granddaughter could use the restroom and I could grab a cup of joe. As we were walking back to my car, someone yelled out my grandson's name. It was my wife's brother and his wife. Unbeknownst to me, they were driving from home south of Dallas to Chattanooga, Tennessee, and we just happened to cross paths at that very Starbucks.
Okay, that's pretty cool. But there aren't that many routes between major cities, right? This was bound to happen.
Well, that's what Barbara said. But she also pointed out that while it may seem less coincidental when you look at it that way, you have to remember the timing. A Starbucks pit stop is very short, so crossing paths over such a brief period is indeed crazy odds.
Gotcha, and I agree. Barbara also made another good point. All of these stories are more or less impressive depending on how you view them. If you predicted these outcomes ahead of time, every one of them would probably qualify for the JREF's $1 million prize. But viewed after the fact, and they all get just a bit less impressive.
Do you think we could win the challenge if we made a million different predictions?
I'm pretty sure they've got rules against that, Wendy.
Darn.
If you enjoy these segments and are planning to attend DragonCon this Labor Day weekend in Atlanta, you can hopefully meet us on the Skep track and see us speak. But we need your help to get there. Go to theoddsmustbecrazy.com and click on the donation link and toss us whatever you think you can spare. Every little bit helps. If you cannot attend, remember that the whole thing will be live streamed. So if we make it there, you can still see us speak, just from your computer monitor.
In the meantime, don't forget to follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, circle us on Google+, and validate us in life. Hit the Submit a Story link on our site to share your own crazy stories. Or tweet the short ones with the hashtag TOMBC.
The Odds Must Be Crazy is a project in collaboration with the Independent Investigations Group in Los Angeles, California. Visit them at iigwest.org. Barbara Drescher is a contributing editor to our blog and can also be found at icbseverywhere.com.
Special thanks to our producer and sound engineer, Brian Hart. Our theme music comes to us courtesy of Mr. Deity himself, Brian Keith Dalton. You can find him at MrDeity.com.
And until the next episode, pick up every hitchhiker you see and ask them where they live. Maybe there'll be a great story in it for us.
Whoa. No. Legal consideration. Don't tell them that.
Party pooper.
In this episode, I have an interview with Victor Stegner. On his latest book, God and the Folly of Faith, Incompatibility of Science and Religion, Victor has been a particle physicist and was on one of the teams who won a Nobel Prize for their work discovering that neutrinos actually have mass in 2002. The author of many books which discuss the interface between science, philosophy, and religion. I got in touch with him to discuss his latest book, God and the Folly of Faith. So, Victor, I have you on today to talk about a book that's, your book, this book's been out for what, about 3 or 4 months now?
Yes, it came out in March or April.
And we're talking about the book, God and the Folly of Faith.
Great.
Now, I've noticed that over your history, over your career, starting around, 2000-ish, you suddenly started to write a lot. Is there a reason for why you had that drought for a little while?
Well, actually, I started writing in 1988 and had a book in 1990, then 95, 2000. So they were coming out about once every year or two on the average. However, in 2000, I did retire from the University of Hawaii.
So, why would you do that?
Colorado, I had a lot more time for writing.
Now, why would you retire away from Hawaii?
Well, there were a lot of reasons. I mean, we wanted to live a little closer to the mainstream, where you can just hop on a plane and go someplace without having to ride for an extra 5 hours. That was a big thing, I think. And we did have family. Right? At that time, all of our family was on the mainland. Since then, our son and his family moved back to Hawaii, so we have a visit to them every year or so. Every winter, we generally go to Hawaii to visit them. But Hawaii is a very nice place. No doubt about it. People really enjoy themselves visiting there. But it is remote, and it's a lot of other disadvantages in living there because it's very expensive. Everything is very high. Housing, especially, is very high. And there is that extra time that's involved when you want to go anyplace. So we moved to what we regard as a practically perfect location in Colorado near Boulder. The University of Colorado is nearby. And we actually live in a town called Lafayette that's 10 miles from Boulder and about 30 miles from Denver. The airport is about 40 minutes away, an international airport where we can, travel the world. So it's a terrific location.
Yeah, it's kind of, I know the area you live in now, it's actually quite nice for that very reason, because middle of the country, you can pretty much go anywhere.
Yeah, it's a good location, and then there's a lot of open space around here. When we hop in the car, want to go to Boulder or Longmont, which is the other big town to the north. We drive through all kinds of farmland and horse country, and it's really quite pleasant.
So, before I get into the book, you brought up something. You're right outside of Boulder. There's a lot of scientists have actually moved to Boulder or have been there the entire time. What is about Boulder that attracts all the scientists?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a great university for science. It's had 3 or 4 Nobel Prize winners. In fact, I think 3 in physics. And there are national labs there. The National Institute of Standards and Technology, it used to be the National Bureau of Standards, that's there. Time is kept right there in Boulder at their lab. The official time that the world runs on is clocked on atomic clocks at that location. There's There's a terrific atmospheric research center. So it's a very, very scientifically oriented campus. And the physics department is very good. I just was reading in the paper today, the local newspaper, about the people in the physics department who were involved in the Higgs boson discovery. There was about a half a dozen of them. A couple of them I know very well, although I don't hang out there that much anymore. It was a good choice from the standpoint of being close to a major university campus.
Talking about particle physics, in your past, do you ever get the feeling that you were somehow excluded from the Nobel Prize since you were involved with the winning of the Nobel Prize and you didn't get one?
Oh, look, when you have these experiments in which you have hundreds of collaborators, you could expect the leaders of the experiment is going to be the one to get the Nobel Prize. You take those two experiments at CERN, the two independent experiments at CERN that saw the Higgs. They each had something on the order of 2,000-3,000 scientists working on them. They can't all get to know. But in any case, that experiment that I worked on in Japan, the last one I worked on before I retired, I didn't have a major role in that, so I certainly wasn't in line for any great awards on that. I just was another collaborator.
You're like a sailor on the ship.
Right.
Well, it's funny because that Nobel Prize that I was talking about, the one from Japan, is dealt with mass, and so did the Higgs, so it's kind of funny when you think about it.
Well, I'm not sure what's funny. It's the way it goes.
Well, it's kind of related.
In what way?
Yeah, the Higgs, imparts mass, and the experiment that you were involved with in Japan was about...
I see, the test thing, right. Yeah. Because neutrinos, what we basically... was able to show that neutrinos had mass, and that was never impossible. Though I mean, it was just that the mass was so small it had not been measured before; it hadn't even been detected before, and so people were generally assuming it was zero mass. But there was nothing in the theory that required that the neutrino had zero mass, so it wasn't unexpected. People have been looking for neutrino mass for years.
I'd venture to say that if it exists, I think it would have to have some form of mass, even if it was very, very, very slight.
No, that's not necessary, because there's three quantities that define matter: energy, momentum, and mass. And the three are related. I mean, when you know two of them, you know the third. And so mass is just one of those three. And in the case of light, for example, photons have energy and they have momentum, but they happen to have zero mass. And that's not an inconsistency. They still have energy and momentum. They still are bent by gravity, which is a characteristic of mass. They still bounce off things. You bounce a photon off something, you can deflect it. So it has all the properties of mass. I think it's a big misunderstanding among lay people is that energy and mass are two different things, when in fact Einstein showed that they were really equivalent. That is, the rest mass of a body, which we just is what we call a mass really today, is equal to the energy of the particle when it's at rest, and when it's moving it has an additional energy called the kinetic energy, and so on. So particles, photons are particles, light is as much matter as electrons or rocks. And energy is better. That's the key thing to remember.
Now, when you think about that, you'd be right, because otherwise sunshine would be heavy over time.
Well, it is, yeah. That was one of the great proofs of Einstein's theory of general relativity, was when it was shown that light is bent by the sun. It had weight. And a major thing. It made headlines all over the world when it was confirmed back in around 1916 or 18 or something like that. So that's old stuff.
Yeah. all that stuff is very fascinating. And you actually delved into that a little bit in like the middle chapters of the current book that I'm talking to you about today. I think through chapters 5 through like 7 or 8, you went through some of the science that about particle physics and things like that.
Yeah, well, this is a point that I always try to make. And in fact, the next book that I'm working on right now, that's probably 90% finished, is going to be about atomism, about the atomism and atheism, about how the original atomic theory of Democritus and others, ancient Greece, is basically what eventually turned out to be correct. And it was suppressed for many years because it was atheistic. So I'm going to talk about all that in the next book. But in all my books, I try to emphasize, because the point of view that I'm promoting is the materialist point of view, that the world is made out of matter and there's nothing else. As far as we can tell, there's nothing else. There's no spirit, there's no soul, there's no substance that's not material. And that's the theme that I constantly try to promote and provide the arguments for it. I provide the evidence for it, and the evidence, the reasons why we think there's nothing else. But now, if any of us who are scientists have to accept the possibility that things will change in the future, if some evidence were to be found for some other substance in the universe besides mass, besides matter, something that was akin to the common belief in spirit, then we would have to accept that and begin to analyze it, and begin to do experiments. And we wouldn't, scientists wouldn't object to that. They would be quite happy to have the opportunity to do more research. Certainly would be well-funded if there ever was any evidence for spirit. and the claim that there couldn't be any evidence for spirit because science isn't capable of seeing that is nonsense, because science is involved with observation, and if there's something out there that has an effect on the world, then we can see that effect, and we can study it with science. And there's so the objection you often hear, that science has nothing to say about the supernatural, which is incidentally comes out of a lot of major scientific organizations, including the National Academy of Sciences, make statements of that sort, and those statements are total nonsense. They're just saying that for political reasons, because they don't want religious people mad at them. And I wish they had a little more courage.
Yeah, and you actually, that's the thing I kind of got from this book, is that you kind of really focused in on that one bit. You talked a lot about how disappointing it is for you that people like Stephen Jay Gould and even, you know, Carl Sagan and many of the skeptics, they don't like to touch religion as if it's just as holy, for lack of a better word, that as anything else. It's just you can't touch it. You got to figure out a way to make it, okay, let's leave it alone. We can't study anything over there.
Yeah, well, that's the big conflict now that has occurred since both Sagan and Gould died. And that was when the new atheists came along, and I consider myself as one of them, but people like Richard Dawkins and the late great Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, all wrote these books that were bestsellers around 2006. And we were under a lot of criticism from not just from believers, from Christians, but from a lot of atheists as well. And so the atheists kind of split into two groups, the new atheists and the old atheists. And basically the old atheists were people who want to accommodate religion. They say religion is here to stay. We should try to work with people, at least moderate believers. I can see the argument for that. I mean, we all understood that made a certain amount of sense. But thinking about it and working it through and discussing it with a lot of people, we basically came to the conclusion that that was better to take a harder line against religion, and for the reason that so much of religion is based on faith, and faith is not something that we should be deciding issues. We shouldn't be setting personal policy and national policy on questions that on views that have no basis in either rationality or in scientific fact. So we decided that it was important to fight that, to not allow that to just go unchallenged. And that's our position. We don't care if other people have an opposite point of view, but that's our point of view, and we want to alert people to that, to the dangers of making decisions based on faith. And you can see that in this country today, starting with the Bush administration, the last Bush administration, where many of the decisions were made based on faith rather than on fact, rather than on science, and they were taking actions that were opposed to the best scientific knowledge of the time, and reproductive rights, for example. They wouldn't allow the National Institutes of Health to put on its own website facts about reproductive rights that were inconsistent with religious dogma. And you know, there's the whole book on that written by Chris Mooney called The Republican War on Science, and he documents all the cases where that took place.
Well, that, and they were kind of proud of it at the time they did it.
You see, that's the thing about the faith point of view. If you believe something on faith, you don't feel you have to back it up because you already know the truth. And if you already know the truth, then anything anybody else says that disagrees with it, even if it's scientists who are making scientific measurements, they disagree with your preconceived belief, then it's the scientists who are wrong, not you. The science has to be corrected. Science has to be redone so that it follows Christian principles. You see that all the time in these last few years. There are organizations out there that are spending a lot of money trying to do that. The whole intelligent design movement was based on that idea that science had to be renewed, had to be redesigned so that Christian truths could be worked into the whole mechanism.
In this book was something interesting, because you mentioned that a lot of times some of the excuses that scientific-minded people or skeptics always give for not getting deeper into religion is because, well, it's stuff we can't test. Well, you actually show in this book quite a few different ways where we have and can test religious claims, and they all come up empty.
Sure, that was the idea. In my 2007 book, I went into a lot of detail on that as well. The failed hypothesis. How, you see, you mentioned Carl Sagan. He was famous for a lot of things, and one of the things that he is often quoted as saying is that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. In other words, he was throwing a bone to believers by telling them that just because there's no evidence for God, that doesn't mean God exists. So he was again playing the role of an accommodationist there, trying to keep from getting them angry at him. But in fact, he was wrong. I mean, absence of evidence can very well be evidence of absence when that evidence that's absent should be there. And I go through any number of examples where if God existed, at least a God, not every conceivable God, but with the God that most people worship, the God that plays an important role in the universe, then there should be some footprint of of that God that we can detect by scientific means. We can't see God himself if he's not made out of matter, but if he has any role in the universe, as most people believe he does, most believers believe that God created the universe, watches the universe, makes changes as appropriate, performs miracles, talks to people, then all of that should be detectable. I give any number of examples. Prayer is one of them, where at some point you would think that there would be evidence that could be tested scientifically for the efficacy of prayer. The prayer should work. And at least one out of a million times, but since there's a billion prayers being said every day, it should be able to find a couple each day, but you don't find any. And the same thing with kind of revelations that people talk about when they have a mystical experience and they claim that they've seen something that about a world that exists beyond our normal senses. Near-death experiences are a common example of that, where people come back claiming they've had a glimpse of heaven. Well, I'm sure that they really thought they did, but that's something that can be tested. If they come back with some information they couldn't possibly have known ahead of time, then we could test that. So there are lots of ways that you can test for supernatural forces in the universe that have some effect. Supernatural forces that have no effect, have no observational effect. We can't test for them. We can't detect them. But then who cares? Since they have no effect, why should we worry about it?
Yeah, you even mentioned the near-death experiences. You had, in one of the chapters, you talked about how they've tried to do this in different ways with surgeons and healthcare workers to set up experiments. And they've all found nothing.
Yeah, in fact, it's a very easy experiment. You see, this is the thing about it. This is not something that requires a $10 billion collider facility and 10,000 people working on it. All you have to do is in the operating room, put some kind of information, write some information down on a card, put it up on a high shelf, out of view of everyone, facing the ceiling. And then very often the near-death experience report, person having the experience reports floating above the operating table. And you should hear all the stories. I mean, there have been so many stories published, books published, with examples of how people have seen all these things and been able to confirm them, you know, by, you know, talking about they've seen the names of the nurses in the room next door. They floated around all kinds of information that they said they could have, but it was never done under controlled circumstances. And so people have tried to do it in a more controlled way by just putting some information up on a shelf, and no one yet has been able to read such information. You know, a bunch of random numbers or something is all you need to do. Very easy, trivial experiment.
And none of those have borne any fruit.
No. And actually, the people who have done it were very surprised, because they were kind of, you don't have skeptics doing these experiments. You have people who really want to prove the existence of heaven. But for the most part, the ones who are properly trained researchers, as opposed to maybe just a nurse or a doctor who certainly knows their own business, but are not trained as researchers, though they're not aware of all the pitfalls in making a research discovery. But if you have people who are aware of that and are honest, even though they want to see evidence for heaven, and they'll make them quite famous, of course, if they did that, they get a Nobel Prize for that, probably. So you've got people who are really biased in that direction, and yet they have to admit, because they are good scientists, they're honest, we haven't seen anything. We haven't gotten any evidence for it. And this has gone on for years.
Well, the thing I loved about that chapter is you even talked in there that you mentioned it in your answer there, that many times the people who did these experiments were people who wanted them to be true.
Sure. Sure, and that's been the case of a lot of this kind of a research, especially the research in parapsychology that goes back 150 or more years. Some of it was done by very well-known scientists. Back in the 19th century, you had very well-known scientists doing this, but they also wanted to believe. They were believers. They wanted to prove the existence of another world. And so they did, at that time, they did bias the results and had it required people going back and looking at the data with a more skeptical view to show what they had done wrong. But as time has gone on, it's become, by the mid-20th century, there are enough skeptics out there looking over the shoulder of the people doing these experiments that they weren't able to pull the wool over anyone's eyes anymore.
What is your thought on some of the odd parapsychology research that's been going on lately with all the claims of ESP through dogs? And there's a lot of that weird stuff going on right now, and it's all by people who claim to be doing good research, but everything I've seen are pretty poor research requirements.
I don't even bother looking at that stuff anymore. I did for a while before I got more into religion or into atheism, but there hasn't been anything. You know, there are organizations like this, like Skeptical Society, magazines such as Skeptical Inquirer and other, there are skeptic magazines all over the world, actually. I get copies from Australia, their regular magazine, that's a skeptic. They sent to me for some reason. Yeah. So there's a lot of people who are following up on these, and you have people like Joe Nickel, I'm sure you've heard of, although he's kind of retired now too, he's an investigator. And of course there's the famous James Randi that needs no mention. So they're out there looking at that stuff, and I've reached a point of diminishing returns on that, except for the quantum mechanics. That's the one place where I still occasionally have to speak up. Now, I wrote a book called The Unconscious Quantum back, I think that was 1995, and that kept things quiet for a while. But then this bestseller called The Secret came out, and a number of other. And of course, Deepak Chopra has been carrying on all those years with his quantum healing and so on. So I wrote another book called Quantum Gods a few years ago, to bring that discussion up to date. So every once in a while, I get into the issue of whether quantum mechanics provides a scientific basis for some of these beliefs. And that's quieted down again now.
It seems to have died down a little bit lately.
Yeah, I think so.
So people are now probably wondering why have you had you go through this long winding road, and it's not really about the book. Now and then I talked about the book, but I think the reason why I did this is because this particular book that I'm talking to you about, The God and the Folly of Faith, is kind of like that. It actually is more like a straight through read. It's more of a collection of different chapters which answer specific questions that people might have. At least that's how I saw it. Is that when you wrote the book, did you think about it that way?
Yeah, it's a subject-by-subject review, and probably a lot of the chapters could be read in different orders for that reason. It's not a continuous narrative, certainly. But I didn't think about that the way I wrote it was just quite natural for me to write that way.
Because I would say that one of the best part about having this book is just to have it to go back to as a reference for the different topical areas, because every chapter is kind of like a summary of a bunch of information in that sphere. It's like at the chapter one is all about the history, and then chapter two, you go down to the caveman talking about the days when we saw actors in everything before we understood any form of reality. And then in chapter three, you went through like the Greeks and the birth of science and how that grew up. And then through, funny enough, through the Arab religions and regions, and then flourished in the West, and then it got kind of destroyed. And then chapter four, you go to Darwin. So it is kind of not a continuous story, but it is a great book to have if you're thinking about something or talking to somebody about something. If you go back to it, you can actually go to a certain chapter and then remember and read it and remember like the certain areas you actually talked about in that section. And it's all related to, you can't prove that there isn't a God, but odds are, if I was in Vegas and my entire livelihood is on the line, what would you do?
Yeah, well, let me tell you one of the points relevant to what you're just talking about. And that is that if you look at a lot of popular books, you will see some of them even by well-known authors, you will see what I regard as a great laziness, namely the won't put any footnotes or endnotes. Actually, the publishers today don't want footnotes. They want all the notes at the end of the chapter because that's the only way that the electronic books can handle them. In any case, the way a lot of them write is, and then at the end of the book, they'll have a bibliography of some sort, so-called for further reading. And I don't think that's good, honest scholarship to do that. I think that you have to put in references as you go along, especially if you quote somebody, you got to get that quote right, and you have to give the exact location of it, and so on. And so you'll find in my book there's lots and lots of notes. And I just have gotten very good at doing that. I've always been involved with computers all my professional career, and so I'm very good at just sitting down and using a computer. So I use various programs that are available for bibliographies and so on. And so I do something that practically nobody I know who writes does. Most of the people I know write, they'll write along, and then later they'll come along and start sticking in the references, and I don't. I put in the reference immediately. When I write something, I immediately enter the reference, so I think you could do exactly what you said. You could use my book as almost like kind of an encyclopedia. You want to learn more about the subject, I try to give enough about the subject that should satisfy you, unless you really want to dig into it further. And if you want to dig into it further, then certainly look at the notes, look at the end notes of the bibliography, and you'll get a lot more information. If you want to be a scholar on your own right, you can do that.
Well, it's funny you said that. So I grabbed the book, and I in my fingers, I pinched off the entire back section, which is all the notes you just talked about. And that section is actually a little bit bigger than two chapters put together. So I would consider that what you said to be pretty true, because you have pages and pages of notes.
You'll notice that, and that's not all. Right after that, there is actually
you.
And I have reviewed spring. I did a lot of traveling all during the spring. Summer, of course, there's nothing going on. And so I'm staying at home. But there is a big meeting scheduled for Denver. And I'm going to be the keynote speaker. It's over the Labor Day weekend in Denver. It's the meeting of American Atheists Alliance, Atheist Alliance of America, or something like that. It's called.
It's the one where Dawkins going to be there as well.
He's going to be there. He's going to be presenting a Dawkins Prize to Eugenie Scott, and I'm the keynote speaker, as I mentioned. There'll be a lot of other speakers there. They're going to be going on a picnic on Labor Day up in the mountains. And so it should be really nice. And I'm going to talk about the Higgs boson, among other things. I mean, the title of my talk is God, Atoms, and the Higgs boson. And I think there'll be a lot of interest in that. I'm going to go back into the history of atomism, to Democritus and so on. It's sort of stuff that I mentioned earlier that I was talking about, yeah, that I'm going to be writing about in my next book. And I want to show the connection between what Democritus and Epicurus and Lucretius said in the ancient days and what we now are talking about today. And I'll give a little information about the recent discovery of the Higgs as well.
Yeah, and I'm sure from you, information about the discovery of the Higgs is actually really interesting, because considering your background is in that sphere of science. So,
yeah. Incidentally, another thing that's worth mentioning is that I do write a regular blog for Huffington Post for their science section. I'm one of the featured writers in that section, and I wrote something up quick about the Higgs and sent it in, and it's posted now. Right now, last time I looked, it was on the front page of their main page, right up pretty high up on the left. So I invite people to check out my blogs. I have some past ones that you can look for if you want. Things on why is the universe made of something rather than nothing, and so on. So I hope people will take a look.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for taking some of your time.
Well, great. It's been great talking to you.
Great. Hopefully myself and Swoopy will see some of you at DragonCon this weekend. If you're there, make sure to come up and say hi. Swoopy will be at the podcasting room next door to the Skeptics room. Also, make sure to stick around for the cool presentation that our own Tim Farley will be giving on Monday afternoon. As always, you can find all the links to the things you heard here on this episode on our website in the show notes at www.skepticality.com.
For more skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
Hey, this is Steve.
Krista.
Scott.
Rick.
And we're the Swimmers. You're listening to WHFR.FM, Making Waves.
The odds of becoming a signed artist and having 3 number one albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism?